Welcome, listeners, to our most recent Science Progress podcast. I'm Andrew Pratt, our managing editor at Science Progress. And joining me today is Tandy Trower, who's the general manager of the Microsoft Robotics Group. And he's here to talk with us about the state of robotics in the United States. Good morning, Tandy. How are you doing?
Good morning.
Well,
I'm doing fine.
That's great. I want to talk a little bit about sort of the work that you've done at Microsoft and the projects that you've been working on there. But before we get into that, I wanted to sort of start off with something a little bit more general about the way people think about robots and robotics. Because a lot of times when people think of robots, I think they return to the images that they know from movies, from TV, from science fiction, sort of the R2-D2s of our imagination. But, you know, in fact, robots have been an integral part of U.S. industry and manufacturing and other sectors for a long time. And something interesting that I've talked with you about before is the fact that a lot of robots that are coming into use, say, for instance, the Roomba that people may use to help clean their houses, don't really fit the traditional molds of what robots are. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you see the future of consumer robots looking like. Is it going to be humanoids, or is it going to be, different kinds of robots that we may not be thinking about at the moment?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question because it somewhat gets down to the definition of what a robot is. I think, and often that's the hardest question I'm ever asked is, you know, exactly what do you think a robot is? How do you define one? And the difficulty is there, as you point out, there are so many different forms of technology that could be considered robots. It's kind of difficult to characterize it and put it all in one place. As you point out, you know, historically, robots have really been a real boon to the factory automation and manufacturing sector. In fact, most cars that are produced today, they go by and they see several robots along the way. And so they've, you know, really been involved in those kind of what the industry refers to as the 3Ds, the dull and the dirty and the dangerous types of work. But what I see happening right now is kind of an evolution of the technology, where it's kind of moving out of the factory floors and starting to show up in our homes. And you pointed out one of the excellent examples of that, the Roomba from iRobot. You know, they've sold somewhere between 3 and 4 million of those little vacuum cleaner robots, and they've been extremely popular. That's not the only form that we see. You know, we see other forms too, like, you know, they're an increasing number of very sophisticated robotic toys that are on the marketplace, you know, whether we're talking about the little Pleo robotic dinosaur from Ugobi or the Lego educational kit or robotic kit or the other one that I've seen out there, too, is like the latest version of the little character. Let's see, what's his name? That little red character from Sesame Street.
The Elmos.
Elmo, yes. Elmo, you know, has become increasingly sophisticated over the years in terms of the abilities of what he can do. And so what we're seeing in that technology really is, I think, two things. One is we're seeing the fact that the technology is becoming increasingly more sophisticated. It's becoming increasingly more oriented toward interacting with human beings. You know, the factory robots have been too dangerous for us, for most people to interact with. They're kind of like the mainframes were in the 70s, and they were big and large and required specialty operators and really didn't affect people in a personal way, except that maybe, you know, whether it was the university computer figuring out, you know, what classes they were going to take or run their grades or, you know, doing some kind of accounting practice, people didn't really feel about them in the same way in a personal way. And yet when PCs came to the market, it really changed that dynamic. And so what we see, as you're pointing out, is, you know, these technologies starting to creep in the door. And they're not just as in the obvious forms, I think, that we've seen so far. They're really in some, we've already seen the evolution in some perhaps less obvious forms. Let's take your car, for example. Like if you had an anti-lock braking system in your car, that really is a form of robotic technology. You know, it's a system that senses the slip of the wheel and adjusts the braking, and it really changes the behavior of how you drive. You know, when I learned to drive, they told me on slippery roads you're supposed to pump your brakes. Well, when my daughter learned, and she learned in a car with anti-lock brakes, they told her just to apply steady pressure, you know, because the system takes over. So that's a robotic system. And, you know, even our appliances, you know, whether it's microwave ovens that you throw the popcorn in and they pop to the right time, or dishwashers that adjust their cycle, or even wash machines. I mean, already our appliances and the things that we live with are starting to acquire these kind of capabilities. So I think that's kind of the first generation that we're going to see. But I've already seen the glimpses of having, you know, being an having had an opportunity to travel around the world. I'm seeing an opportunity, additional evolution of the technology, of where it's starting to, where PC, traditional PC technology is starting to get integrated in, and we're starting to see other forms. You mentioned the Japanese robots. Those are definitely an example of, you know, particularly the humanoids. Those are a very advanced form, a very challenging form of robots. Those kind of robots, while the technology is rapidly coming to the forefront, I think we're going to see generations of robots somewhere between the Roomba and those kind of robots in an earlier generation. You know, robots don't all need to walk around to be useful. So I think we'll see a generation of these mobile robots that are really based on the kind of piggyback on top of the PC technology that we see today, and leverage the fact of what we have and on the PC technologies. We have all the wealth of information and productivity we have, plus married with the ability to be mobile. I think we'll see a generation of those come in first. Then I think the next generation will be amplified. We'll see manipulation come in soon after that. And manipulation, the ability for the robot to safely manipulate things in a human environment as well as be mobile and function safely in a human environment, I think will be the great boon to the industry.
In your work surveying U.S. robotics, you've seen robotics become sort of a key educational tool. Can you talk a little bit about how robots can get students interested in STEM fields and how they can also draw in a diversity of students?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think education is one of the another big opportunity for this technology. And I think it's incredibly important because, you know, today the U.S. is ranked as about sixth in engineering bachelor's degrees, following China, the EU, Japan, Russia, and India. And in fact, it's starting to look back up again, perhaps with a change in economy. But traditionally, you know, computer science in the U.S., there's been a steady decline in its enrollment. It turns out, though, that robots are just this marvelous motivating device that if you stick a robot, I don't care if you're talking about grade school kids or high school students, if you put a robot in the middle of the room, there's something captivating about the technology. You know, at Georgia Tech, for example, they have been able to use robots as a way to teach basic computer science, and they get more. They've been able to stem the tide of the declines in computer science by using this technology. But even before the college level, you have programs, you know, there are a number of programs throughout the U.S. which are just tremendous in terms of their benefits. For example, something like the FIRST organization, which was started by Segway inventor Dean Kamen, a brilliant man, but what Dean loves to talk about more than anything else other than the inventions he's created is the fact that he founded this organization called FIRST. The primary competition is for high school students to build robots that compete, but there's also programs for lower age grades as well. I had the opportunity at the recent event to kind of welcome the students to the Seattle regional event that Microsoft sponsored. And that was just tremendous. They actually doubled the number of teams that they had, high school teams that they had from the previous year. And they had this very complex competition where the teams had to they build these robots to distribute these like foam balls from one location to another. And it was just the engineering was just incredible. But the key thing about FIRST is it's not just about the kids building the robot. It's about teamwork, collaborative interaction. I mean, teams not only get points in the competition itself, but they also get points for collaborating with other groups. So you often see one team help another team out. If one team is having problems with their robot, you'll see another team go over. They're motivated to help the other team make sure that they can compete. It's about marketing, too. I was led around by one of the guides that led me around. was a senior from Spokane, high school in Spokane, and she mentioned that, you know, she didn't really get to participate much in the actual engineering of the robot. That wasn't her expertise. But she got to participate in helping promote what her school was doing, what her team was doing, and she was so excited about that. The results from FIRST are just incredible when you look at some of the history. And as I said, they're not the only competition. There's BotBall and a number of others that are out there that have similar types of results. But, for example, if you look at the statistics that the FIRST people provide, they mention that students that participate in their competitions, that are involved in their teams, are 50% more likely to go on to college and four times more likely to major in engineering. They have some incredible stories about, you know, the different high schools and the benefits they provide. There's even a high school in Denver, Colorado, which is really set up to be an alternative for convicted felons. It's supposed to be, you know, students that just, you know, in the early in life they got into crime. And the school is really offered as an alternative to prison. Over 13% of their students go on to do post-secondary. Only 13% of their students normally go on to post-secondary education. But those that participate in the FIRST competition, 80% of those go on to do a post-secondary education. So the impact of this technology is just incredible. And it's also very important, right? The industry needs to feed itself. You know, if we're going to see this breakout of this technology in the next 10 to 20 years, what we really need is a set of engineers, and this goes back to the point I was making earlier. Right now, the U.S. ranks behind much of the major world populations in terms of engineering students. And so particularly in this country, to have these kind of motivating competitions that not just get kids excited about robots, but the whole thing about what it means to, you know, work collaboratively on an engineering project, whether it's from the engineering side of the hardware or the software, or it's just the organizational principles or the presentation principles, the marketing, all these things are just, you know, the fact that you can use a robot, which is just provides this kind of motivation, is not only beneficial from that aspect, but it's critical to us being competitive for the future in this technology.
You were talking about your travels to learn more about robotics. Can we go back a few years and talk about the project at Microsoft that Bill Gates got started and that you've been heading? He asked you to go out and sort of explore the state of robotics. You traveled all over the country, engaging with
That's
people
right.
in the field. You know, what did you learn while you were doing this? And also importantly, you know, in the intervening years, which are not that many, what has changed since you first went out exploring?
Well, it was really a great opportunity. You know, I've been at Microsoft for about 27 years now, and I've had an opportunity to play around with and lead and manage a number of different projects at Microsoft. But this was a unique challenge that I got to go out there and talk to the community that's out there. And the first thing that I would have to say is it's a very diverse community. You know, there's not just a single segment of it. There are people that are using robots in education, people using robots. We talked about the industrial factory automation usage. There are people that are doing very intensive research out there in the university community. And there's even this, you know, this evolving beginning of an emerging generation of these kind of consumer robots. So the first thing I would say is what I discovered is it's a very diverse community. And in some ways, again, you know, it kind of parallels the early PC industry in that it wasn't just a particular segment. It wasn't just people who love computer science or something like that. It was really quite a diversity of people who are interested in using the technology in a variety of different ways. I also discovered that it's definitely a worldwide phenomenon. There isn't just a single place in the world where this is happening. Traditionally, you know, Japan has been the hotbed of kind of the robotics development, and people continue, and there's still great work that's being done in Japan. But what I see now is it's becoming more widespread throughout the world in terms of the investments that are going on in the space. In addition, it's not just the investments, but every major economic entity in the world seems to have robotics on their list of significant technologies that they want to participate in and believe will be an important part of their future. So there's this all this excitement and anticipation of something that, that's coming. And that was actually the thing that motivated Microsoft and me particularly to show an interest in this. This was that this community was very much communicating with us at Microsoft, saying, "Do you realize that there is something significant that's starting to happen? There's a whole new industry. It's not just the traditional factory automation area. It's really blossoming in a number of different areas." And they actually invited Microsoft to kind of participate in that. It's also an area where there's just this tremendous amount of research going on, just breakthrough research. You know, 10 years ago, something like vision recognition technology was still very much a black art amongst many developers. But today you can find a number of examples of where you can just go out to the web and download several algorithms or libraries to put this even on some of the simplest little robots that are educational robots that are on the marketplace today. So I found all these great things, you know, and the technology becoming more affordable, more accessible, available to a wider audience. But I also learned that it's not all just rosy out there. It turns out to be that there are some development challenges, right? I mean, the difficulty is in terms of trying to bring software from one platform to another. Every robot is kind of its own world unto itself. The hardware still needs to go through a little more evolutionary refinement. I mean, it's kind of like, again, using the PC analogy, it's like we're looking at the Apple IIs and the Commodore PETs and the Sinclair Micros that were available in the 70s, and it wasn't until 81 that when IBM came to the market that we started to see a more stable platform. And so those are still some of the challenges. And then probably the biggest one that everybody identifies, again, this is very analogous to the early PC industry, is the fact that, you know, there really hasn't come to the front a compelling application. You know, in the PC days, we used to call those killer applications, but that's probably not a good context or a term to use.
Not
around
quite the
robots.
Right metaphor.
No, that gets the wrong metaphor across for robots, I think. But it is true that robots, just like PCs, need that kind of compelling application set, those solutions that really demonstrate the value. And I think we still haven't seen that. We've seen a tremendous amount of innovation in terms of the technology. You know, with the DARPA Grand Challenge, we saw the ability of teams to build cars that could navigate through themselves through deserts or even on simulated urban roads, even with other vehicles running around and obeying the traffic rules. So we actually see the evolution of and the innovation going into the technology, but we still haven't seen come to market yet a compelling reason other than perhaps for entertainment or education. We're still waiting to see that thing that will really drive everybody to want to have these in their home.
Well, let me follow up with the point you were making about the DARPA Urban Challenge. Can you explain that particular contest a little bit and maybe even talk about it a little bit from the perspective of this is set up by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, and this is a way of using public policy to shape and incentivize, you know, further research in robotics. Can you talk a little bit about the success that this contest has had and what it looks like?
Yeah, it's, you know, DARPA, of course, is, as you mentioned, is an agency that helps fund research, and generally it's for the defense industry. And DARPA set up it was originally called the Grand Challenge, and then the last one they renamed to the Urban Challenge because it was a different scenario. Rather than originally it was set up to the original challenge was set up where teams had to build vehicles that could autonomously, not by remote control, but autonomously navigate through roads in the desert. And so there was no one on board. There's just computers on board that with sensor systems that had to be able to navigate along these roads. It was so successful. It didn't start out to be successful. In the first year that they ran the challenge, there were a number of teams that participated. And even the best team, which was from Carnegie Mellon, led by Red Whitaker, who is just a real pioneer in the robotics area, even they failed. They got 7.5 miles through the course. They had built their their robotic car on a Hummer platform, and it got stuck, and they had to get shut down because it couldn't free itself from where it got stuck. 1 year later, so DARPA did a brilliant thing. They just banked the money and offered the challenge again, and in the following year, four teams actually finished in the regulation time. And Red, even though he came back with his teams, he actually had two teams that qualified in the end. Maybe I'm getting that mixed up with the third one. But anyway, Red came back again, and it looked like he was going to take it this time and that his vehicle was going to get all the way. And he was just narrowly beat out by one of the fewer, I think he was a former student or at least a former professor there at CMU, now at Stanford, Sebastian Thrun. And Sebastian, with his team, narrowly beat out Red. And so you actually had four teams. So in the span of that time, the technology, the teams were able to, not just one team, but at least four teams. There was actually a fifth one, I think, that completed the event as well. It just didn't make it in the regulation time. And then DARPA kind of said, okay, well, that's great that people can navigate across desert roads all, you know, just with the vehicles by themselves. Let's up that again. They took over an old Army base with streets, and they basically set it up so that the vehicles then had to navigate across these streets. And they had to obey the traffic rules, you know, stop at the stop signs. There were other vehicles traveling, other robotic vehicles as well as human-powered vehicles traveling on the road at the same time. Now, the real incentive for all this, the DARPA's incentive, was because they had a congressional mandate to to develop technology that will allow them to have a third of the military vehicles be able to operate autonomously. But what I believe will come out of this, even though it was done with kind of a military mentality, will come some tremendous innovations, I think, even the way that you and I drive safely on the streets today. In some ways, that's not so unusual. You know, DARPA is also kind of responsible. They're the same evolutionary agency that was responsible for the ARPANET, which became the foundation for the Internet that we have today. And so it's great. I think it's a great way of using public money, and why it may have had defense purposes, the implications and the ramifications it may have down the road are just tremendous in terms of, you know, pushing the technology. Here was an investment they made, a fairly modest investment. It was $1 million, but it was still a modest investment overall when you think about that in terms of getting all these brilliant minds to solve a very hard problem. And what came out of it was not just one solution, but many solutions to really advancing the state of the art in terms of technologies that I think will not only, as I said, allow us to drive more safely in the future, but advance the whole state of the art in terms of bringing robotics into our lives in a very personal way.
No, that all makes sense, and probably, like you were saying, a spectacular return on investment. If you know the prize
Absolutely.
Money is $1 million, but you have you know, tons of graduate students pouring their hearts into these projects. Well, I want to return to some of what we were talking about a minute ago about sort of what are the possibilities for some of those critical applications that new kinds of robots might be able to take on that would really open it up into new spaces? And one thing as well that you've spoken about are some applications for robots that can support citizens with disabilities or help care for, you know, aging segments of the U.S. population. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the kinds of advances or possibilities that we might see in this area where robots can help people accomplish things in their daily lives or assist in healthcare settings as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, I think this is, I mentioned before, you know, that robotics really still needs that compelling reason why people would want to have one. And I think, you know, rather than technology just going out and trying to defend itself as a reason, this healthcare, I think, is one of the biggest opportunities and the biggest needs where technology, particularly digital technology, which includes robotics, but not as exclusive to robotics, is the biggest opportunity. For example, you know, today in the world, in the U.S. alone, there are almost 40 million people over the age of 65, and it's expected in the next 20 years to almost double. Not only that, but the number of people that are over the age of 80 is expected to triple. What this means, is saying it a different way, is we have more people that are going to be in the senior category, and more of these people are living longer lives. At the same time, what we're finding is that that already there's a gap in terms of the care industry to be able to take care of all these people. So the question is, how are we going to solve this problem as things go forward? Everyone knows that as we age, our physical and our cognitive capabilities start to diminish. We become also more prone to, chronic types of issues. For example, it was revealed to me recently through Dr. Greg Pesco, who is at Brandeis, the fact that at age 65, your chances of getting Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease increases exponentially. So how do we deal with this problem with the prospect of increased cost? We have a greater population, increased cost, fewer people to take care of us as we all age. How are we going to deal with this? And it's not just in the U.S. This is a worldwide phenomenon, which if you look at the population curves, which traditionally have been this very nice pyramid where, the smallest part of the pyramid, the population of the older people was the smallest part and the younger people was the largest part, that's actually flattening out, and it's expected to actually invert as we go into the future. So robots, I think, and other forms of digital technology are a great way of trying to address this gap that I see, not as replacements for care workers, but as a way for us to extend the care support network that's there. And the ways I think that it can do that, for example, are in terms of providing a role in terms of communication. And communication is in two ways. One is in terms of allowing there to, just as PCs have become great tools for communication as much as they are for productivity, whether it's email or other kinds of communication. For example, my daughter, who is graduating from high school this year, she communicates with her friends through her PC more than she does on her cell phone or on the house phone. So it's been a great tool for communication, and I think that's particularly important because as seniors, their social network logically becomes smaller as you age generally because, your friends may be there, may not be. It may be more difficult for you to get out and see your friends and family. And so being a communication aid, but it's also in terms of connecting with the care network. So the ability to allow doctors and nurses, rather than to have to necessarily make physical visits, to be able to communicate and to monitor the state of where people are is very important. There's also a role, I think, in the area of memory aids, whether it's just, remembering to take medications, which I think is a critical issue. One of the biggest problems that you find with seniors is they often have to be on a regime of several medications, and applying some technology that can remind them, that doesn't care how many times it reminds them, never gets tired of reminding them or helps them stay on their regime, I think could be very beneficial as well. There are other benefits too, I think, like, doing providing a simple means of transportation of items. If you look at most walkers, just regular walker technology today, they all have, they not only allow the person to stand and move around, but they typically have a little basket where people can put things in there and be able to move them from room to room. Mobility is a significant issue for the senior citizens. And so I think, if we talk about robots that are mobile devices, and even if they don't have manipulation, I think in the first phases we won't see them with manipulation. We will see that eventually, and that will be the breakthrough the thing that really makes the technology break out. But I think even in just, robots in some sense with cup holders would be a valuable aid for moving things back and forth for seniors from one place to another. So I think there are a number of ways that this technology could be applied to help solve what some people consider almost going to be a potential epidemic in terms of trying to, how do we deal with these growing population of seniors that are going to need assistance? How are we going to, we need to find some way to solve this. And I think that while robots may not be a complete solution, they can be a part of that answer.
No, that's really interesting, and particularly as well because the countries that we were talking about in terms of the development of their robotics industries, particularly Japan or South Korea, as I understand, are having similar demographic shifts. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the ways those countries have invested in robotics versus the way that the United States has, and maybe. Are there cultural differences that you see? We were talking a little bit about sort of what robots look like. Are they the Honda Azimo robot, or are they the iRobot Roomba here? Are there significant differences you see between the way these countries think about how to integrate robots into society?
I think there are some differences. In Japan, traditionally, well, Japan, again, has been always at the early forefront and continues to be a serious innovator in that area. And even there are surprises that I discovered in terms of how things are changing. In terms of, for example, Toyota has made very strong statements about their plans to move into this area and to make investments, and that they plan to actually introduce some of what they call their partner robots, of which they've already demonstrated, into this space. It's interesting also, though, by visiting in South Korea, I've noticed the government there making significant investments to try to allow their local industry to try to catch up with where the Japanese are going. And I've seen some amazing robotic innovations coming out of that area. But some of those have even already shown up in a kind of a preview form at the Consumer Electronics Show for the last 2 years. I've seen some of the robots there are not out of Japan. They're actually out of South Korea. What we do see, though, other differences that we see, though, is the fact that, for Asian cultures, particularly in Japan and in South Korea and other places in that area, in that region, it's not just the functional aspects. In the U.S., I think, and then more in the Western world, we tend to be more focused on what can this technology do for me? And that's why the Roomba has been tremendously successful in terms of, providing a basic function, cleaning the floor, vacuuming up the floor, a time-saving device. And that's kind of the Western thought, I think. In Japan, and in the Asian region, that's important too, but that's not the only thing that's important to them. To them, they've grown up with a culture, that you could go back to look at something like Astro Boy or some of the other models of robots that the Japanese culture has birthed. And you see that they're very much in the role of human assistants, and they have a very social role as well. And in fact, when Sony would demonstrate, after Sony did the Aibo, which was their robotic dog, they introduced did demonstration of something called Querio, which was this little humanoid. And they, like many Japanese vendors, to help demonstrate the tremendous amount of technology that robot has, have done kind of traditional kind of Japanese dances. And so the social side of interaction with robots is very important there. And I think that's what also drives them to take the really tough challenge of trying to build robots that have a very humanoid appearance and that walk or, have facial expressions or things like that. Where in our country, we're not so much interested in that. That doesn't seem to be so much of an important part of it. Although that's not incredibly clear that that's absolutely true. Because if you look at the studies now that have gone on in terms of people who own Roombas, it turns out that they become very attached to them. They give them names. There are a number of studies that have been done. I can think of a couple of them done by Georgia Tech, for example, that have studied Roomba owners. And as I said, they give their robots names. When they send them back, they put, put their names or they engrave something in them so that they need to be repaired, they get the same robot back. It turns out that it's not only just with people who have these Roombas in their home. If you look at the stories about the soldiers who have used the PackBot, which is the other part of iRobot's business, and use those to do surveillance or defuse IEDs or whatever, that even when those have to go back for repair, the teams very much want them back. They really think of them as a team member. So this this whole issue, while it isn't so obvious in Western culture that we form, you know, kind of a social attachment with this technology, I think the nature of it is almost makes it unavoidable. I mean, it's something that if it interacts with us in a way in our homes, in our social context, that we do start to do that. We just may be less willing to admit that that's really a part of what we look for in the Western culture. So it's great, though, because what you see out of all this is a real mixture of research going in through a number of ways. It's focused, you know, in the U.S., particularly in our country, we talked about DARPA being a major motivator and the military being a major motivator for a lot of the research and development and innovation that's going on. And so there's a tremendous amount going on, but there hasn't been as much research go into the area of, like we were talking before, about healthcare and how we could, you know, how we might be able to use these in a way that would be very helpful to people. But that is going on in other parts of the world. So the good news is, you know, it's not so focused on just one application. It's the fact that we have a worldwide multi-spectrum of interest and development of how to apply robots is just enriching the whole category.
Certainly. Do you see a need or a space for incentives or a public policy push to get people to do more work in robotics, say in with health applications or outside of the militarily driven ones that are happening now?
Well, I think the military applications have been good. As I said, the DARPA's investment in the Grand Challenge and the Urban Challenge have been really great, just in stimulating the thinking and the technology and the innovation that I think will have ramifications and implications in terms of improvements to the overall technology. But I do think that there could be it would be useful or helpful. I'm concerned that maybe in this country we may fall behind, because in the other parts of the world, the focus isn't so much on just the military side of things. It really is to more, you know, whether it's care or education or other kinds of uses of how this technology can be used. And in fact, there are several agencies that are really looking at that right now. There's a consortium of U.S. professors led by Henrik Christensen at Georgia Tech, and includes a number of the significant professors from all the U.S. universities, who has been, you know, is trying to build awareness about the fact that we really do need greater investments in some of these other application areas, that while we may derive benefit from the military applications, that there are opportunities for us to invest in this other area. And to, you know, it's not just a matter of research funding, it's a matter of investing in the educational value. I mean, we really need to build up our own foundation of workers and students and researchers that can really develop this technology. It's a matter of building, changing policy to make this technology more accessible to people. You know, if we're talking about healthcare, how can these devices be easily certified so that they can be covered by insurance and things like that? It's also investments, though, in other technologies that feed into this that are not just robotic-centered. For example, robots, for them to be functional and operational in the home, have to have a source of wireless power, whether that's batteries or other kinds of technology. And so the innovations, in some ways, it's actually good that we're facing this crisis of, trying to build more fuel-efficient cars, because that's driving us to more creative ways and more innovative ways of building battery power, and whether it's fuel cells or batteries, whatever it is, or even wireless transmission of power, those kinds of things will be critical to give these kinds of technology, robot technologies, will benefit them as well. Likewise, you know, just the encouraging the ability and the availability of wireless technology in the home. I think that overall robot technology in the home that's just operating in isolation, that's just, you know, a device that's, you know, just like your refrigerator, just operating by itself, is far less interesting and it's going to be far less powerful than a device that can hook up to the internet and be able to take advantage of the processing capabilities that may be on other computers in the home, but even outside the home. They'd be able to, you know, harness these, you've heard about perhaps these kind of cloud computing scenarios where you can take an army of servers and you could solve very complex problems. And it allows the technology, therefore, on the robot to be much lighter weight. And having this connection does a number of things that makes it a more positive equation. So those are some of the things that I think, you know, our investments in, not just in robot technology, but in technologies associated with that, and policy also that helps encourage educational value as well as encourages the ability for these types of products to find their ways into the home. As I said, likely these assistant care robots that I talked about, they're not going to be inexpensive. I don't mean that they're going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, but they are going to cost more than a few hundred dollars, I think, to get, you know, the initial stages. If we look back again at PC technology, you know, it seemed like somewhere between $3,000 to $5,000 was kind of the early entry point. And I'm optimistic that perhaps these helper robots, these assistive care robots, will be cheaper than that. But it's still, if you're talking about something that's going to handle the vast amount of seniors, we need to find some way to be able to certify that these are safe, as well as to be able to have them be funded and included in not only in institutional situations, but also in the home setting.
No, those all seem like very important concerns, but you know, worthy challenges to address. Let me sort of close by asking a question sort of about the personal context. You mentioned that you have been at Microsoft for about 27 years and have been involved in a whole lot of different projects. You managed the basic programming software. You worked on the first two releases of the Windows software. And now you're working in robotics. How does this kind of work fit into, you know, such a long and well-established career in the technology industry?
Well, I've been very fortunate, at Microsoft to have an opportunity to kind of work at kind of the forward edge of technologies that are out there. Whether, as you pointed out, whether it's programming languages that I think help, you know, set the stage for the early PC industry, or the parts of the operating system that have now become, you know, Windows is now a part of PCs today, and a number of other things. And so it's been great because it the opportunity has given me a chance to kind of look forward. And this latest project, you know, it really was something that started off really because I was working in Bill Gates' strategic team, which was really supposed to provide him advice in terms of what was going on inside or out, or just an extra set of eyes and ears for Bill at the time while he was still here. And the fact that I was able to, the opportunity allowed me to connect with a number of different people who were meeting with various different parts of Microsoft, allowed me in some ways uniquely to kind of synergize between all these different parts and really put together kind of the fact that, you know, it wasn't just the educators in robotics that were talking about it, but it was also the people in the university space and also in the commercial space. And the fact that it was interesting that I had an opportunity to hear that all these people were interested or had a similar vision, and they were all inviting Microsoft to participate. And then the accessibility in the company of being able to present this to the senior executive at the time at Microsoft and say, Bill, there's, you know, here's what I'm seeing, here's why, and then be able to have the opportunity being enabled through him as well as other executives here at Microsoft like Craig Mundy and Rick Rashid, who heads up our research, and Craig, who has really taken over part of Bill's role as he's left, to be able to be sponsored and funded by them to kind of look out into this new space. You know, we really are newcomers to this space, and to be able to learn from that space and to be able to go back to that community and then offer something back. Because what we did initially, what we've done so far, is we built a development toolkit that we hope will help, you know, provide opportunities for more people to participate in this. Because, you know, just as the community told us, that the success of the robotic industry as a whole is really dependent upon contributions from a lot of people, not just the ones who have all the resources, but in the same way that the ask from the community was, you know, do something that helps robotics draw from the creative abilities of the larger community, not just those professors who are well-funded, not just the companies that get money from the government, but really, you know, allows everyone to participate and work as a community. And that's really what our focus has been. And so it's probably been one of the most exciting things. I've worked on so many exciting things at Microsoft. This probably, though, tops the list in terms of the most exciting piece of technology where I see, you know, for me, it's a little bit like deja vu. You know, I'm old enough that I've been through the PC evolution and seen it go from kind of toy computers into very practical devices. You know, from where friends and family used to ask me, why do you have such a thing as that Apple II computer sitting on your desk, to where they all have their own computers today. And I'm seeing this again in the same way in the robotics community, but it's different in the sense in that it builds on the already rich foundation that the PC and the web have already set before us. So the possibilities seem kind of endless to me. It's like the industry, it's an evolution of the industry that is going to make this technology more useful and more valuable to us as we move forward.
Well, that all sounds pretty fantastic. Tandy Trower, General Manager of the Microsoft Robotics Group, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share with you.